and then say that this is part two of a dual lecture, a dual presentation, June 20th, 2009, on Lecture 85, The Distortions of the Instincts of Self-Preservation and Procreation, and Lecture 86, Self-Preservation and Procreation as Instincts in Conflict. The other concept that's gone into extensively in these two lectures, in a place where I personally found it, it clicked in me, I got it, is the discussion of the idealized self-image. So in this sense, the guide is talking about the idealized self-image is a direct result of the distortion, the idealized self-image results directly and immediately from the distortion of self-preservation. In effect, the idealized self-image is a reaction to defeat. And it's a reaction specifically to a power defeat. Now, the guide also says, by the way, that there, even though we talk about three personality types, everyone has sections of these in their personality. There is no clean-cut division here. So there is no reason type, there is no will type, there is no emotion type. These types are ways of segregating out qualities of our personalities and our reactions with others so that we can more clearly see them. But an actual human being is a conglomerate of these three. And they, a person can be a will type, a predominantly will type at work, a predominantly emotion type at home, a predominantly reason type when it comes to philosophy. There's a huge amount of variety in this. So what I'm inviting is that we not be simplistic about identifying this is, I am this type. Better to understand in a given situation, I am exhibiting these qualities. That's a more useful way to look at these divisions. So the idealized self-image is a result of having suffered defeat in a quest for power, and since everybody has a will component, we all seek power or control at some point. And when we feel that defeat, basically what we're looking for is what would protect us? How could we be that we would never feel this humiliation or defeat again? That's where the concept, that's where the building of the idealized self-image comes from. And the idealized self-image is exactly what it says. It's an image of how we should be, how we must be to avoid defeat in future. And it is idealized. So it's not based on what we are capable of doing or being. And that's where it turns deadly. It is an ideal that may require us to be bigger, stronger, have more character, have more self-control than we actually have. So depending on your family, your circumstance, your culture, our idealized self-images may be similar in a family, or a village, or a country. And when you've got an idealized self-image in a larger environment, even if you might have developed in a different, slightly different way, it's almost magnetic. It sweeps you up in it so that you become involved with the idealized self-image of your community. So in these ideals, how can you possibly argue honesty isn't necessary? Of course honesty is necessary. Almost every culture says honesty is important. Even cultures who lie, steal, and cheat have places where you don't lie, steal, and cheat. There are rules in every single society on the planet, even if those rules allow for latitude in certain situations. So every culture, every civilization has ideals. And they have their own rules about how those ideals are supposed to be used. So in the idealized self-image, you imagine yourself saying, I need to be honest, I need to be upright, I need to be hardworking. Well, that's lovely, but what if you're actually an artist type? And while you may be hardworking, it doesn't show up the same way as it does in other types, and you're setting your ideals up to match those types. So in other words, if you look at a family of manual laborers who go out every day and work up a hard sweat, and you say, that's the ideal, that's what I should be, somebody who physically throws themselves into an activity and sees it all the way through. What if that's not who you are? And that's where the idealized self-image breaks down. That's where the problems are. It's just as easy to look at a family intellectual and say, I should be smart. I should be perceptive. I should be happy with my own thoughts for hours at a time. Well, that's, again, lovely. But what if that's not who you are? So who are you? You may be somebody who needs to see things delineated carefully, who needs to write things down, who needs to work from lists. It does not mean you are lesser than those people, just like not wanting to throw yourself into physicality means you're any less than the people that you're looking at as your ideal. So in the idealized self-image, we set up a straw person, we set up a concept, and we say that's what we should be. Now, if that's what we should be, we take on at that point the obligation of beating ourselves up every time we don't meet that ideal. So you can see this tumbles immediately into us and them, me against myself. If I have an ideal and I can't meet that ideal, then I am wrong. Either I am wrong or my ideal is wrong. Can you feel the duality in that statement? Win, lose, me or them. And yet this is internal. This is your own perception of who you are and who you want to be that you have frozen into a should. No longer should I aspire to this. I need to be this. So the healthier you are as a human being, the guide says, the weaker is your idealized self-image. The healthier you are, the more happy you are in your own skin, with your own being, with your imperfections. Then your idealized self-image, that's a nice plan. That's out there. We'll kind of put that up on the wall like a poster, and we'd like to be that one day. But the connection between the two is much, much weaker if you are willing to accept who you are in the moment. It's nice to have a goal pasted on the wall. The problem comes in is when you put that on the wall, and that is now the equivalent of the Ten Commandments. That's what you must be as fast as possible, and any deviation between the two is not acceptable. That's the difference here. Secondly, the stronger the inner conflicts, the stronger the difference between the real and the idealized self. So in other words, if you put up an idealized self that does not truly represent who you are, then there's going to be some conflict. And the stronger that conflict is, the reason that conflict is so strong is your idealized self-image does not reflect who you are and can be. So let's take bodybuilders, for example. Let's say you aspire to be a bodybuilder, but you don't have that physique. If you're a healthy, well-adjusted person, you can say, I'm going to do the best I can. I'm going to work out. I'm going to get some equipment. I'm going to get some help and some training. And I'm going to try to get my body into the best shape I possibly can within my time constrictions, within my lifestyle, but also within my physical limitations. But if you choose an image that is simply not attainable by your physical form, it's so far away, you're never going to get there. And that image, you're looking at that image literally saying, I must look like that. And I look like this. The difference between those two realities, creates tremendous inner conflict. Now, if you've got all this inner conflict going on, you're spending more and more time in this internal war with yourself rather than in communion with others, getting love, or building a life and being out in the world and creating success for yourself, which may be a way for you to develop power. So both a quest for power and a quest for love are sabotaged if you are in conflict within yourself because of this idealized self-image being false, unrealistic, and a tyrant. The third point the guide makes is that the phrase used in this lecture, at least in the unedited version, is desire life. But at some point the guide says the desire life or daydreams are always a good indication of what the idealized self-image is and of the nature of the pseudo-solution. The idealized self-image shows up more in the desire life. Now, what I presume the guide means by this is this. Look at your fantasies. Look at your dreams. Do you want fame and fortune? Do you want power? Do you want control? Or do you want love? Do you want connection? Do you want to belong? Do you want to feel the give and take between yourself and other people, whether individually with a lover or community, with a number of people or a community? Now, you can see where these could mesh together. Literally, a politician who runs for office, on some level they have a desire for power. But the actual nature of running for office, of being elected, of representing the people, means you're going to have to, if you're elected, rather than being a tyrant and selected for the job, but if you're elected, you're engaged in a process where you're going to have to go back to the population over and over and over again. If connection is not what you want, it's going to feel like you're on a treadmill, constantly having to convince and persuade people that you are the best choice, that you hear them, that you understand them, and getting them to admire and respect you. This is going to be a constant and eternal process if you're an elected official, even though you also exercise power. But if you are selected for power through having met certain criteria, and you don't have to, in effect, re-qualify for it except by pleasing certain people, your boss or the person who chose you in the first place, and you can hold that power because of it without having to get a plebiscite, without having to get reaffirmation from people over and over again. So this is how you can look at your fantasies. What are you after in your fantasies? What do you daydream about? It is an excellent way for you to see what is your quest. Now, in your daydreams, it is very unlikely that your daydreams are going to be about withdrawal. And that's why withdrawal is a secondary. So in your daydreams, you may go through, daydreams or night dreams, you may go through a story where you seek out a beautiful, desirable person, and they, in the dream, it doesn't go well, and that person rejects you. At that point in the dream, you may withdraw. In that point in the fantasy, you may feel that you want to pull back from the situation, but that is secondary to having wanted to reach out in the first place for both connection and approval, the give and take. If in your dream you want power and you find yourself at risk, you may freeze or hide or pull back. Again, it's a secondary reaction. So what you're looking for when you're looking for your idealized self-image is what's your primary quest? What is your principal drive? Understanding that you will have both. Another point about the idealized self-image is that it must show in the rigid commands, the shoulds and musts, the anxiety and guilt when the compulsions are not lived up to. It shows in certain expectations from the self and from others. So one of the hallmarks of the idealized self-image is a rigidity. And there's a rigidity because if it isn't rigid, it's not an idealized self-image. So using all three words, it's idealized, which means it's not real. It's a self-image, self meaning it's about you, not about them, about you. And it's an image. And an image is not flesh and blood. An image doesn't take into account, I've had a bad day. The image stands there and says, get over the bad day, because you need to be all things to all people. So the image is what makes the whole thing inflexible and phony. And lastly, that if you want to see what your, that looking at your fantasies and daydreams and night dreams can give you an idea of what your primary quest is. So I'll pause for a second, just in case there's any questions.
Yes.
Yes.
I didn't get exactly, the message behind the daydream and the night dreams. I mean, the examples you were giving us.
Okay.
That if we dream something, it means this thing. I mean, that part, I didn't get it.
Okay, so let me repeat this. I appreciate that because heaven knows I'm not always clear. What the guide is saying is that as a tool for trying to help you see which quest is strongest in you, the quest for power or the quest for love, that you look at your daydreams. Now, I am presuming that this would also include your night dreams. But I believe that this would be the distinction. When we daydream, we have more control of the situation. When we have dreams in our sleep, we sometimes dream things that we don't like, that make us uncomfortable or unhappy. So in terms of seeing what your quest is, these sleep dreams are not as valuable as the daydreams. So, let's say that you're driving in your car and you're daydreaming. You're imagining what's going to happen tomorrow when you meet your friend for lunch. And you imagine at the lunch that you are received with love and that she's very pleased to see you, and that you have a pleasurable experience, and you find yourself filled with happiness about this. What the guide is suggesting is that this would be a dream where your quest is for love, where you wish to experience pleasure, rather than a quest for power, where what you do not want to experience is defeat, and you want to experience some level of winning. All the guide is suggesting is that in your daydreams, you can notice a pattern. You will not dream the same thing. You will not daydream the same thing over and over and over. You will sometimes. But you're going to get a mixture. The idea is to notice where the preponderance, where the majority of daydreams lead you. Do they lead you to connection and pleasure? Or do they lead you to glory and winning and away from defeat? So does that help differentiate? I brought in sleep dreams because they can be used. And I'm glad you asked the question because, like I say, with daydreams, we have more control, and so daydreams more accurately reflect what our day-to-day compulsions might be leading us towards or might be about. So a daydream more accurately reflects what our emotional needs are day-to-day. So if you want me to explain a little bit more, I will, but perhaps that did it.
I mean, mainly the daydreams are what we want. I mean, what we imagine and what we are thinking about it, right?
Right. And so what the guide is suggesting is that you notice is that does that tend to be about power and control or love, pleasure, and relationship? Which one? Now, this might make it easier because the next thing I was going to do was I was going to go into how we do path work. So let me go there, specifically answering your question. Without naming it, the guide does talk about the equivalent of daily review, because what he talks about is noticing. And daily review is about noticing. It's a specific way to notice. It's a way of training ourselves to notice what we're thinking and feeling. So, to go to this point, if you accept that the guide says that daydreams can have some valuable information for you, the question is, why I don't really, I don't remember my daydreams. How can they help me if I don't remember them? On using a form of daily review, and I'm going to keep mentioning that term because I think daily review is the most underutilized tool that there is, because people see it as tiresome and a chore instead of seeing it as supportive and helpful. Daily review is only a matter of making a few notes every day. So in this case, you might sit down at the end of the day or the beginning of the day or during the day, totally up to you. And you might recall some daydreams that you had during the day. Now, a daydream can be 5 minutes, it can be a half an hour, it can be 30 seconds. But see if you can write down your daydream. Daydreaming, for instance, a daydream can be when you thought about what would happen tomorrow in very rich detail. That's not just thinking, oh, I have to be at lunch tomorrow at 12 and I have to meet Susie. Daydreaming is imagining the lunch with Susie. Daydreaming is imagining yourself walking up to the cafe table and sitting down. And that's a daydream. When you are imagining what something could look like or be like or feel like, you are daydreaming. Write down what you're daydreaming about. And then notice what your feelings were about that. Were they about, oh, I have to be on top of this presentation because I must win the promotion or I must win the argument? Or was it about, I really need to connect with Susie? So you want to write down a few words to describe the daydream. Daydreamed about daydream. Lunch with Susie. Then you want to write down what you felt. I felt threatened. I felt frightened. I felt warm and comfortable. I felt accepted. Whatever. And then you want to write down what you thought. What were your thoughts about the daydream? What were you hoping for? What were you looking for? If you write down those three things about your daydreams for 2 weeks, what the guide is suggesting is that if you look at that, and at the end of 2 weeks, you try to see, was this a quest for love, a quest for power? Was it looking for pleasure? Was it looking for control? You will begin to see a pattern in your daydreams. And once you begin to see a pattern in your daydream, it will help you see what form your pseudo-solutions take. In other words, how this lecture applies to you. Now, in a particular 2-week period of time, it is possible that you will be in a unique situation handling something very specific that is only a fragment of your overall life. So you don't want to take it too seriously if it's a very, very focused 2-week period of time. You will know if that is common. You will know if that's how you are most of the time. But even if you're only like that for 2 weeks, it will tell you something about yourself. For instance, when I am, I'm inventing something here. When I travel on business and I'm under stress, I see things in terms of win-lose. I see it as power. Well, how would I know? Well, because I know myself, and I know that I took these notes while I was on a business trip, and I know I'm stressed, and I know I feel I have to meet certain goals and I have to be a certain kind of person in terms of win-lose. But I also know that because I remember my other daydreams. I know this is special. I know that this is not normal for me to be focused on winning arguments. That normally my daydreams include other factors. They include meeting people, talking to people, imagining holidays, imagining cruises, imagining what my life is going to look like in 5 years, imagining what my new home will look like. These are different than the kind of daydreams I might have during a very stressful 2 week period. So when you do daily review, you want to keep a context of the larger picture. You need to know that you're on a 2 week business trip and you're under stress. Alternatively, if you're on a 2 week holiday, you might have many more daydreams about pleasure than you are used to. But you are the one who knows that you're on or about to take a 2 week holiday, and that these daydreams might reflect a different aspect of you than that appears during daily life. And so what the guide is suggesting is that daydreams will indicate to you what your quest is. And then later in the lecture, the guide talks about doing the work, and part of doing the work is, says in the lecture, the first major step in becoming aware of the emotions is an inner permission to find out what you really feel. So you need to basically make a commitment to yourself that you want to start finding out what you really feel. Guide says this has to be cultivated by prayer, meditation, and by a daily resolution of intent. And that's what I'm saying daily review represents. Doesn't use the same word, but if you make a daily resolution of intent, practically speaking, a daily resolution of intent needs to be manifested somehow. If every day I say I'm going to live my life better and differently, what's the next step? How am I doing that? And one of the ways to do that is to start noticing. And one of the best ways to notice and not allow yourself to conveniently forget or overlook or exaggerate or underestimate what you're thinking is making notes every day. So in other words, we're such strong people, and if we decide that we are X kind of person, we are fully capable of ignoring all the evidence that we are Y kind of person. And that if you decide that what you want to do is to find out what you really feel, you need to start noticing what your actual feelings are day by day. Because while you can fool yourself in your head and you can exaggerate or over-dramatize something, the day-to-day evidence of what you felt is very hard to fake. So daily review with the intent to reveal your own feelings is one of the best tools you can have for finding out what you feel, what actually happened in your inner life, what conflicts go on day in and day out in you. And any mental exercise, for instance, if I asked you, what kind of person are you? Intellectually, you could give me an answer that isn't real. We can do that. We can be in our idealized self-image and simply describe it to the other person without realizing that that's our idealized self-image. But we don't do that on a day-to-day basis. On a day-to-day basis, we fall short, and we are at conflict with ourselves about this. This work is about coming down to the grassroots level, about dealing with who we are, about noticing the conflict, and perhaps adjusting the idealized self-image a little bit, allowing it to be more flexible, allowing ourselves not to beat ourselves up for our imperfections. But also, if you're trying to find out who you are, the guide is saying it's a very important discernment among in terms of personality and drive to understand, are you on a quest for power or on a quest for love? And the day-to-day evidence of data review can help you uncover which of those is predominant in your life at this time. Understanding that 3 weeks ago, or 3 years ago, or three decades ago, a different force may have predominated your life. That's interesting to know. But to start with, we need to know who we are today. So in terms of this last section, doing the work, walking the path, that the first part of this work is becoming aware of our emotions. Now the guide also says that after we make a positive intent to find our emotions, don't be surprised. Because the first emotional level of awareness usually will be a welling up of resentment that you were never conscious of and which are connected with guilt and anxiety. And that is why the guide talks about the idealized self-image. Basically, he's saying he's inviting you to look at your emotions and warning you that the first thing you may see could be a lot of inner anxiety and conflict. And he's trying to say, but this is why. You may not have admitted that you were dissatisfied with yourself, but you were. Now it's time to see that you are dissatisfied. And then, under that, or as the next step, we are looking for an establishment of balance due to facing truth and changing where and whenever possible. The balance was not attainable. So, we make a positive intent to find what our feelings are. And then we open the doors, open the floodgates, and all this stuff pours out. Well, then we have to look at that. There are reasons why we may have been at conflict. There are reasons why we may have put ourselves in conflict. You need to see the conflict and then sort through it to find out why it's there. So, like I say, the way I phrase it is, when you say, I want to know, and you open the door, don't be surprised. It's like cleaning a closet that's had a bunch of stuff put in it, and you open the door saying, today's the day I'm going to clean the closet, and the situation comedy version of everything in the closet falls on your head. Well, of course, you haven't looked in the closet for a long time. Psychically, energetically, you've been stuffing things in that closet without admitting it or realizing it. So you are going to get a little bit of an explosion at first that you may not be fully prepared for. But that's okay. That's a natural course of events. Don't judge the situation. Notice the situation. And then notice what these conflicts are made up of. Again, that's the tool of understanding that there might be an idealized self-image. There might be a poster on the wall that we've been comparing ourselves to and storing up those resentments and those feelings of failure. I numbered these in the handout that I posted on the website. The fourth aspect is that you will be able to find the main components of your idealized self-image. And that's where I digressed and talked about daydreams. Looking at our daydreams is a way of finding out the components of our idealized self-image, the components of our drives, so that we can then see where these drives might have created conflict. You can have a quest for power and not admire it. Those two things can exist. Well, if you have a quest for power and you don't admire it, then basically you don't admire what you're doing. Day in and day out, that's going to breed a lot of anxiety and resentment. That goes in the closet. Again, you open the closet, all this stuff comes out. But that's okay. It's part of the process of cleaning it up. The fifth point the guide makes is after this is explored, the underlying neglected and shamefully covered core of your problem will evolve into emotional awareness. In other words, you got to open the door, you got to let the stuff fall out of the closet, and you need to start sorting through it. And you may not be happy with the fact that you've been storing up so much stuff, but that's okay. And if you feel some shame, you're going to have to let that go. You're going to have to let that wash over you. Because feeling shame is the equivalent of pushing this stuff back in the closet. And finally, the guide says, this is a painful process, my friends. Guide doesn't mince words. He acknowledges. This is a painful process, my friend. The courage to go through this pain, which you may encounter on various levels as well as the core, has to be experienced. But your inner will to go through it must always be cultivated in you. The inner will to inexorably face the truth in you, regardless of whether or not it is pleasant or flattering, must always be resolved afresh. And what I feel the guide means there is this. It doesn't get easier. You get better at it, but as you get better at it, you may look more closely at your life and its conflict. Another way I try to phrase it is that once you get an idea of what's in front of you and you've sorted through it, then you crank up the microscope and you look a little deeper. Another silly analogy is if you've got a really messy room and you go through and you do a first pass of cleaning it, you're not going to get everything the first time. And then you come back in the room 15 minutes later and the clutter's been removed and now you see the dirt. So you go through and you clean the dirt and you go away for 15 minutes and you come back. If you truly want to clean, and we're using a silly metaphor here, if you truly want to clean, now you get out the scrub brushes. Now you get out the nail files. Now you get out the toothbrushes. And you start seeing even where the dirt has entered the crevices, where the finger marks have marred the furniture, where the upholstery or the cloth has been dirtied. And you go through more and more passes. It's not on a psychological... please forgive me. On a spiritual level, you will never be done. That's not the point, to be done. The point is to engage in the process, because as you engage in the process, you'll get better and better at it, you'll see finer and finer layers, and you will actually achieve both the power and the pleasure that we all want and deserve. There is no reason why we should not have personal power, but personal power is usually the result of character, of having done our work, of having kept our word, of being reasonable, of accepting defeat when it is inevitable, to be graceful in defeat, to be magnanimous in victory, to be generous to the other even if they do not approve of us or reject us and say, I can understand that. You have feelings and I have feelings. I wish we were together on this. And I will work towards being together on this. But I accept that today there is a sense of separation, of disappointment, of being alone or left behind. So someone who addresses life like this is the kind of person that we think of as wise. And this is the kind of person who usually wields true inner authority and power in a group. Now, that does not mean that other people aren't grabbing authority and power and doing what they please, but this is a spiritual quest. This is not, Patrick is not going to tell you how to get the top job. Patrick is not going to tell you how to get elected. Patrick is not going to tell you or help you get the right person or lover or friend. What Patrick is about is a spiritual journey towards the evolution of your being. And in the evolving of your being and the clarifying of your conflicts and the appreciation of your real self, the natural, inevitable consequence will be pleasure. And the other natural, inevitable consequence is that people who have done similar kinds of work or who understand to any degree that kind of work will see and understand what you have done and wish to engage with you. And that is where personal power comes from. So that's why this work needs to be truly understood as a spiritual quest, which may or may not manifest. So the last note that I put is that all of... Yes, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I just say that what do you mean with that, that the, those may not manifest?
I am saying that what I said was Patchwork is not a tool to get a better job.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Patchwork is a spiritual path.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And that means that for some of us, even if we do everything to the best of our ability, we may not get what our mind imagined the reward should be. Okay? Because this is a spiritual quest, not a worldly quest. That this work is about inner happiness. And inner happiness can exist in poverty. Inner happiness can exist in illness. And inner happiness can exist in solitude. So we want to be very careful when we look at this. We say, well, I did all these things, but my friends didn't come back. Well, that's not the point. This is a spiritual journey. Your friend may have reflected to you where you were in disharmony, but once you become harmonious, that friend may or may not be part of your journey. And we need to be very, very careful to not attempt to use pathwork to make something happen, something specific happen on the material plane. Does that make sense? I mean, it may not make you happy to hear that, but do you understand what I'm saying?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. And that is the difference. Pathwork's not supposed to make you happy. It's supposed to help you develop. And happiness will come with self-development. It will come. But the human beings think that happy is having money in the bank, and happy is having friends, and happy is having a good job. That's not real spiritual happiness. And we need to understand that there is a difference. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, in some way.
Okay. I understand that there may be some confusion there, but I think that it might be more protest than confusion. But if you look at how you feel about what I said, there may be a place where there's an assumption that if you do everything right, you'll be happy. But that is not what spirituality is about. Spirituality is believing that if you do everything right, right meaning spiritually right. Happiness is inevitable. You don't have to work for it. It simply happens. When we try to gain happiness, there's a reaching out and wanting to grab something specific. And that's what this very lecture is about. So my invitation to you, and I do not mean this in any derogatory fashion, is to sit down and read through these two lectures, considering that a strong desire for something specific could actually be the distortion of either self-preservation or procreation. Let me say that again. The strong desire for something specific can actually be a manifestation of a distortion. And so you may have found a very valuable place where you say, but I want this. And these lectures are about saying, well, what if you let it go? So at one point in the lectures that I did not go over, the guide invites you to consider, how do you respond when you are defeated? The question is, defeated in what? Well, it depends on what you see defeat as. So on some level, it's nice to know which quest you're after, because someone who's defeated in their quest for power, that's going to be a different kind of defeat, and it's going to bring up different kinds of emotions than someone who is on a quest for love and is defeated by not getting approval or love the way they want. So it helps to know which one you're after, and then look at how do you handle defeat? What feelings come up? And again, you can use daily review for 2 weeks to look at your daydream, figure out which one you have is activated more often, power or love, and then do daily review for another 2 weeks and look at every time I feel defeated, this is what I feel. And to notice where you may feel that that's death and you have to do something about it, when the reality is, you simply didn't get what you wanted. This goes back to the beginning of the lecture when I said that we imagine danger, we exaggerate not getting what we want as death. Anytime not getting what you want is death, you are in a duality. You're in a power current. You're in a love current. Because there is very little that if we don't get it, we die immediately. Of course, there are those situations, but I know of very few people who face them on a daily basis. What we face is imaginary death. And in that imaginary death is the key to distortions in our soul. So perhaps this will help. Let me close off with this. To do this work at all, it is important to develop a positive attitude. And here are the two quotes from the guide. The more you become aware of and understand the cause and effect of negative emotions, the weaker they will automatically become. I'll read that again. The more you become aware of and understand the cause and effect of negative emotions, the weaker they will automatically become. Now, why is that positive? What the guide is saying is negativity does not get stronger because it is looked at. It gets weaker. So as bad as a feeling is, by looking at it, by becoming aware of it, and understanding the reasons for it, it begins to soften and dissipate. It becomes weaker. And secondly, a proper inner balance will begin to take place. You will cease being, inwardly or outwardly, aggressive where it is unjustified. And you will be aggressive where it is healthy and constructive. So by becoming aware and understanding about these negativities and conflicts, you will become rebalanced internally. And instead of being aggressive to try to get something that isn't real, negative aggression, you can still be aggressive. You can still exercise your will. You can still be in the world. You can still be you. But that aggression will be healthy and constructive. You do not lose. And as I have said before, in a joke sense, you win even though there's no winning. So language tends to be dualistic. If you can take the time to look at all these factors, if you can take the time to become aware and to understand, if you have the idea that then you'll win, you won't. But once you understand there is no winning, that this is a process, that you're here on the planet to learn, and learning is a day-to-day, month-to-month, year-to-year, decade-to-decade adventure. To some degree, that's when you win, when you no longer see it in black and white.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Oh, okay, because I didn't know if I was in the mode. What is how should we relate the night dreams with the day dreams? I mean, there is a message behind that, because it's our unconscious, or what?
Well, in previous lectures I've talked about the deeper levels of spirituality. As I said in the beginning, this lecture is about feet on the ground, life, death, being in the wrong place, doing the wrong thing. This lecture is about how we go wrong. In previous lectures, I've talked about the spiritual meaning of life on Earth.
Okay.
And that is to learn.
Okay.
And one of the ways we learn is by being wrong and letting go, by getting wrapped up in an illusion and finding our way out. There is a toy called a Chinese finger puzzle, and it's woven pieces of it's woven thing, and you put your fingers in, and if you pull, the woven pieces of fabric or whatever tighten up, and if you pull, it grabs your fingers and you can't get out.
Huh.
But if you relax and push your fingers together and just slowly wiggle them out, you can become free. To some degree, that's what this lecture is about. That when we're fighting for a solution, we're like we're in the Chinese finger puzzle and we're pulling hard, but we're not getting free. And we may actually enjoy the struggle and be afraid to relax and let go. And from a spiritual perspective, growing is about relaxing and letting go and looking at the situation and figuring out what is appropriate. That's growth. It is childish to simply tug and tug and tug. It is childish to say, but I want, and not understand that what you want may not be spiritually appropriate for you. And your spiritual task is to learn to relax and see other alternatives. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So I thank you very much for your question. There is no way in one presentation or one lecture I can include everything. So I can easily understand why after only a two-hour presentation, I haven't made things perfectly clear. I'm not supposed to make things perfectly clear. My hope is to challenge and pique your interest and give you some things to think about so that you can continue your own personal work.
Well, that's perfectly clear.
Thank you.
Thanks, Shan.
Okay. Oh, thanks both of you for being here. I very much appreciate it. Hope to talk to you another time.
Bye, Riley.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye, love.
Bye.